My name is Daisha Clay. I'm the audio librarian here at Classical 91.7. While I'm a real librarian, I have a deep, dark
secret.
I know very little about classical music. I grew up listening to rock, and I know something about jazz. But when it comes to classical, but I really want to learn. So, every week on this show, a classical music expert will give me a piece of classical music they think I should know, and then we'll discuss it. Come learn with me in the classical classroom. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and joining me all the way from Atlanta, Georgia, through the miracle of technology, which, because our regular studio has been co-opted by our mothership's fundraising campaign, is basically a very long piece of string and two cups, is bassist Michael Kurth of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra. Michael has played with the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra since 1994. In addition to playing in the orchestra, he's also composed music that the orchestra has played. He is composer in residence with the Riverside Chamber Players in Roswell, Georgia. I assume composer in residence just means that they give you a giant house to live in and that you can't leave until your job is done.
Well, I was disappointed to learn when I was asked to be composer in residence for the Riverside Chamber Players in Roswell that I wasn't actually in residence at the artistic director's house, because he has a swell house. the residency thing is sort of a misnomer.
Yeah, it would seem to imply an actual residence.
Yeah, disappointing, I know.
Michael, can you talk a little bit about how many alien life forms you see on a daily basis?
When I visit Roswell, I see lots of alien life forms. We call them OTPs here in Atlanta, which means those that reside outside the perimeter. I'm an ITP, inside the perimeter, villainous city dweller. The aliens tend to stay away from this part of the neighborhood.
Right. I'm surprised that you're allowed to share this much information on a podcast that, you know, goes national. But if the government allows it, you know, who am I to say otherwise?
Well, I was assured that once people found out it was me that was your guest, they wouldn't tune in, so.
So, we should probably talk about classical music, too. What are you going to be teaching me about today?
That's a good question. I suppose we'll be walking hand in hand through Beginner's Guide to what it's like to be a bass player in an orchestra. We can talk about what it's like to write for the orchestra you play with. We can talk about the disappointments of being a composer. The way you disappoint your colleagues and your friends and your family and yourself pretty much constantly.
Well, I love the idea of all of these, but especially love the idea of talking about the bass and being a bass player, because I feel like I wonder if being a bass player in a symphony orchestra is kind of like being a bass player in a rock band, in that it's sort of the unsung hero of the music. I feel like in hip-hop and in jazz music, like, the bass is really highlighted. It's very kind of standout part of the music, and often in rock and classical, it's sort of, I mean, it's clearly what keeps the music together. Without it, you know, the music would just be a bunch of jangly bits. But what is it like to be a bassist in an orchestra?
Well, first thing I'd say about it is being a bass player, you have to be versatile. And I've played jazz, and I've played rock, and I've played, you know, all sorts of different genres. I play bass guitar as well. Being a bass player, as you allude to, it's one of the most important functions in just about any style of music. And it's universally important. Just about any genre of music you can think of has a role for a bass player, whether it's the tuba in a Balkan brass band or the washtub bass in a band that features a washtub bass.
Right.
But I like to think of the role of the bass as sort of, in a narrative, it would be the sidewalk that the main character walks on.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I like that.
We're very rarely the main character, but if we weren't there to provide the setting and the surface and the canvas on which the melody is painted, the, like I said, the sidewalk that the character walks down, the character would, I guess, not have a place to walk.
Right. No, so it's like this really essential thing, but it's often overlooked in the same way that, you know, we overlook a sidewalk. You know, it's like this very important part of our journey, but you don't think, man, that sidewalk is hot. You know, like...
Well, to be honest, not all of us get into music for the attention.
Is that so?
Yeah, I really adore and cherish the role of the bass player. Mm-hmm. I love accompanying. I love being in the background on the side of the stage, sitting in the back row where I can provide the foundation for the orchestra or the band or whatever group I'm playing with, but kind of avoid the spotlight.
Yeah, must be kind of gratifying to know that you are sort of secretly responsible for keeping the whole thing moving.
Yeah, gratifying and a relief also to be ignored. Bass players have a sort of axiom they live by that our bass sections are successful in inverse proportion to the amount of attention the conductor pays to us.
I like that. Well, could you sort of quickly tell me some secrets about bassists that no one suspects?
Secrets about bassists that no one suspects. Our right hands hang lower than our left hands. Mm-hmm. And if you stand any bass player up against a wall, you'll notice that their right hand hangs indeed lower than their left hand.
So you're asymmetrical people. Okay.
Yeah. We use more of our fingers than any other string player except for harpists, because when we pluck, most upper string players limit them to their plucking to one finger, sometimes two. Bass players use 2, 3, 4, even 5 of their fingers to pluck.
Wow.
Our music is easier because our instrument is harder. We until a few years ago, you never heard virtuosic solo bass playing of a caliber that would compare to violinists or cellists. Our instruments are huge and heavy and unwieldy, and they're basically big pieces of furniture.
Yeah, they are huge. Like, how tall is a bass?
I think without its end pin out, a bass is probably about 6.5 feet tall.
Holy crap. That is a huge instrument.
One time I kicked a hole in mine.
Oh, no.
And I dare you to try kicking any other string instrument and see if it lasts.
So wait, you kicked a hole in it and you still played it?
Well, I had it repaired.
Oh, okay.
The tip of my foot made a hole in the bass the size of the tip of my foot, which any other instrument would have trouble accommodating, but a bass is big enough to bear that kind of injury.
The bass is badass enough to survive that kind of violence.
Yeah, I recommend it to anybody who has a bass.
So, as a bassist in an orchestra, how many times a week do you, and this is something that I've never asked, we've actually had a few classical classrooms where we've spoken specifically about a particular orchestral instrument, and something I've never asked anybody is, like, what is it like just on a practical level? Like, how many times do you practice per week? How many hours do you put in? And then how many performances do you do in front of live audiences and things like that?
Well, with the Atlanta Symphony, we're considered a major league symphony. We perform throughout most of the year. We've recently started taking the summers off, unfortunately. But throughout the year, we do, in general, at least one different new program each week. For instance, last week we had two different programs. We had our principal guest conductor, Donald Runicles, was conducting us in a program of Brahms. Mm-hmm. But it so happened that Yo-Yo Ma was available to be booked on Wednesday night, so we did our Brahms symphony, and then the second half of the concert, Yo-Yo Ma played the Elgar concerto, so we had to prepare the whole Brahms program plus the Elgar cello concerto.
Wow.
4 rehearsals, mm-hmm. and then we had 4 mm-hmm. concerts, 1 with Yo-Yo Ma and 3 with the orchestra.
And like how long does an individual rehearsal last?
Anywhere from 2 to 3 hours.
So you're doing something like in between 8 and 12 hours of rehearsal for each performance?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Okay. So well,
for each program, I mean, once we've done the program, we're done rehearsing. We just repeat the program.
Right. What drew you to playing the bass? Was it just that thing that you were talking about where you get to kind of hide out and, or what was it?
It was general music class in public school in Maryland. In the end of third grade, we were shown some pictures of the instruments we could choose for the next school year.
Mm-hmm.
And I was tall and the bass was tall. And their only other bass player was graduating the elementary school the next year, so I guess I'd shown a little bit of aptitude in general music class. They were okay with my suggestion that I try the bass. Uh-huh. And it kind of stuck. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the camaraderie with my friends. I enjoyed the challenge of learning new music and a new instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And my teachers and parents were all very supportive and willing to drive me around to lessons and youth orchestra rehearsals and festivals and stuff.
Yeah. Can you talk a little about what kind of stuff does every young bass player start out on?
Yeah, the bass solo repertoire is basically divided into stuff that's awful and stuff that we steal. Very few respected composers have written for the bass. The names that rise to the top of the bass repertoire pantheon are Koussevitzky, who was much better known as a conductor.
Mm-hmm.
Bottesini, who was much better known as a conductor.
Mm-hmm.
Dragonetti, who was much better known as Mozart's friend. And Dittersdorf, who is not known outside of the bass, and maybe some violists. We steal music every chance we get. We steal cello music, we steal violin, flute, viola, bassoon.
So you basically, like, you swipe these pieces that are preferable from other instruments and you make them your own?
Yeah. I consider all public domain music anyway to be completely open season on it for bass players. We steal a lot of Bach. We steal a lot of Bach. We also steal a lot of Bach.
So I'm thinking Bach is your jam.
Bach is my jam.
Does that involve a lot of arrangement then, like when you're taking a piece that's meant for organ or viola or, you know, what have you, and you're playing it, what?
Did you say organ?
Organ, Todd. You know, you're taking a piece that's meant for another instrument. Do you have to then, you know, translate that into bass ease?
Yeah, it mostly involves just moving the pitch down. Because we obviously have a different sonic frequency range than a cello or a viola does. So mm-hmm. I'll take the fifth cello suite in C minor and move it down to A minor.
Mm-hmm.
I think on the one hand, Bach would approve because he was a composer and he wanted to get played.
Yeah.
And he translated a lot of his own music for different instruments and different mm-hmm. situations. And on the other hand, I don't think he would argue because he's dead.
Right. Dead people do have a hard time arguing with things. Kind of turns into a one-sided conversation.
Yeah.
This is actually a really good segue into talking about your being a composer. Did having to sometimes do your own rearrangements of other people's work lead you into composing, or what got you into that?
Yeah, in fact, that's almost exactly how it started. I was scheduling some outreach performances with a cellist friend of mine, Joel Dallow, with the symphony.
Mm-hmm.
And the outreach program is where we'll take symphony musicians into schools and community centers and libraries and
mm-hmm.
do little smaller scale performances. And we're talking about what we can play. And we said, there's nothing. So why don't I just arrange some stuff myself?
Right.
And heck, why don't I just go ahead and write something original, because most of the stuff I can find to arrange, I have to dig and dig and dig for it, and
Yeah. Didn't
seem worth it. It seemed easier just to write something myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I arranged this piece called The Mean Old Pony Tango for Joel's string quartet. Encouraged me to write some more, and I kept foisting new music onto him and little cutesy little character pieces. And he finally said one time, you know what, I have a commissioning budget now. Why don't I commission you to write me an entire four-movement string quartet? And I said, no. I said, I don't think I'm ready for something that serious.
You said no to... Oh, okay. So you just didn't feel ready to be sort of responsible for commissioned work?
Right. I take the craft pretty seriously, and I don't want to take somebody's money for doing something I'm not really prepared to do.
Right.
But I thought about it, and... The next week I said, you know what, I think I'm ready. He said, well, tough, I already commissioned another composer for that slot. So I said, well, good, that gives me more time. And I spent a few months writing my first string quartet. And he enjoyed playing it, the audience received it really well, and I felt good enough about it to give a recording of the broadcast of the performance to Robert Spano, the ASO's music director.
Uh-huh.
And I got really lucky because he listened to it and said he loved it and he wanted to commission me to write for the orchestra.
Nice.
And I was baffled. I thought he was kidding. I thought, that's really cruel to tease me like that. And I kept, every time I'd see him over the next couple of weeks and months, I'd look at him inquisitively, like I needed reassurance that he actually meant what he said.
Mm-hmm.
And he assured me. He said, yeah, I want you to write for the orchestra. So I did.
This is great.
Thank you.
It's so playful.
Well, it was written for a young audience, so it was. I tried to write a melody and a texture of accompaniment that would hold their attention.
Yeah. So... This was your sort of maiden voyage piece, and is this something that the orchestra has played?
No, I have arrangement of it for a string orchestra that some local school orchestras have played, but
okay.
When I write for the Atlanta Symphony, I write generally a little more heavy,
yeah,
lengthy.
What's a piece that you've written for the orchestra?
Well, the ASO had started this for Spano's 10th anniversary season, a program of 10 separate orchestral fanfares, mm-hmm, to be played throughout the season to celebrate his anniversary with the orchestra. And yeah. I was playing that season. That was 2010-11. We played a few of these fanfare overtures, and I thought, this is not so humble of me, but I thought, I think I can do that.
Yeah.
So I wrote something, and I had a little... computery sounding demo of it and offered it to Robert Spano, and it was kind of funny because he never got around to listening to it. And I was talking with a colleague, the librarian Rebecca Beavers, and she said, why don't you give it to the artistic administrator instead? So I passed the CD to Evans Mirages, our artistic administrator, and he loved it, and he said, tell you what, we have 10 composers on the hook for writing a fanfare, but I have a feeling at least one of them is not going to meet their deadline. So if we lose any of them, we'll stick yours in the slot. And I was thrilled. I saved that phone message from him for a couple of years, just to listen to anytime I got discouraged. And I think I wrote something pretty happy and celebratory. It was called May Cause Dizziness. Because of contractual rules, I can't distribute the recording of it, but there's a concert band version of it. I was listening to some Pixies, and I was one of my favorite songs is Wave of Mutilation.
Oh, love that song.
And something about the time signature and the rhythmic pulse of it made me think of the Baroque form of a sarabande, and I'm probably the only person who's ever said that about a Pixies song. But I pulled out my cello. I play a little bit of cello too, and I came up with a very Baroque treatment of the Pixies song, and the melody is a little bit hard to hear in there. If I sing along with it, which I promise not to do, it becomes a little bit more apparent. But
yeah,
I arranged it for viola, and I think the recording you're going to hear is a violist, a wonderful violist named Jennifer Stumm.
All right, let's hear a little bit of that. I hear it.
Are you tempted to sing along?
I'm a little, but I like my listeners too much to do that to them.
How thoughtful.
That's fantastic.
Thank you.
It's definitely, it's like it's, like I hear the song in it, but it's such a unique take on it. I kind of love that this grew out of your hearing of, you know, what is it called? A saraband?
Yeah, a saraband is a Baroque dance form that is in triple meter with the stress on the second beat.
Okay, so you heard this Baroque music in Pixies music, and that's what this grew out of. That's really cool.
Yeah, I think that's one of the hallmarks of a great piece of music is that it's translatable, transferable, versatile enough to be stretched and and reworked. Mm-hmm. Think of Proud Mary by Creedence Clearwater.
Yeah.
And then think of the Ike and Tina Turner version.
Oh yeah.
it's a great song, and it's made maybe better, at least different and equally valuable by treating it a little differently.
Yeah. This is something that I've talked to a couple of people about, that rock music doesn't see the same sort of reworking and reinterpretation that classical or jazz music does. Like, it's a pretty rare song, a rare rock song, that gets redone by other people and that, you know, gets new life breathed into it.
Well, I think so much of the way pop music is constructed is dependent on the production for its for its value. Mm-hmm. It's not the content or the form or the structure that's the valuable part of it. It's the production.
Yeah.
When I think of, like, one of my favorite songs lately was Pompeii by Bastille. But you almost can't hear that song without hearing the production that they put into it.
Yeah, and it's like pop music is so sort of personality driven too. Say you hear another band playing a Radiohead song, you think, "Oh, there's another band playing a Radiohead song." You don't think, like, I was talking with Rachel Barton Pine about Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto, and she based her entire lesson around the fact that, you know, there are all of these different musicians bringing their own phrasing to this one piece, and it's like a new piece over and over again. And you kind of don't get that with rock music as much. So this piece that we're listening to right now is very cool.
I like
to see that.
The Mendelssohn Violin Concerto is one of my favorite pieces.
I liked it too.
Basically for the same reason I like a lot of pop music. Mendelssohn could write hook. Like very few other composers do. Like, there's this one little motive that hooks me in the violin concerto, which is built on a pentatonic scale. Da 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 dum. Which is built on the same pentatonic scale that most pop music is built on. And every time the violinist gets to that phrase, I just get goosebumps.
I love that. So you've got this one aspect of your career where you play in this orchestra, and you have another where you compose music. Which, like, is there one that you find sort of more fulfilling, or that you sort of prefer?
Playing an orchestra is satisfying and enjoyable, and it's more pressure on the spot because you're responsible for every sound you produce in real time. But at the same time, you're not the one ultimately responsible for the
right.
for the product. You're one of 80, 85, 90 people on stage working together towards the same goal. And there's some comfort and some anonymity in that.
And plus you get to sit in the back row, so.
Yeah, you get to sit back and watch all these amazing colleagues just play the crap out of their instruments.
Yeah, I bet that's really cool.
Composing is more frustrating when you're in the process of writing. Mm-hmm. Because it's a lot of time spent just ironing out nuts and bolts and tweaking little things. But I think it's more gratifying when you can sit back and listen to somebody perform your music. That's the biggest adrenaline rush you can get, is to sit there and know you've written something that's the best craft you can create and that you hope connects with audiences. And it's just sitting on the edge of your seat waiting for the connection to occur between the performers and the audience. And to know that you're responsible for creating that.
Which of your pieces should we go out on?
Do you want something happy or something down?
I'm going to say happy.
How about Boogie Alarm?
Boogie Alarm?
Yeah, because I realized when I had a cell phone that had the option of programming different alarm sounds, that I wanted one that would wake me up with the feeling like I needed to boogie.
I like that. That's the inspiration for the title. That's great. Michael Kurth, thank you so much for being on the Classical Classroom all the way from Atlanta, Georgia, 60 time zones away from Houston, Texas.
Thank you for the invitation.
So that about does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. If you have a question or just like to chat, send me an email at dclay@houstonpublicmedia.org. If you would like to find us on the web, you can go to our webpage, which is houstonpublicmedia.org/classroom. You can also, of course, find us on iTunes. We now have our very own SoundCloud page, and you can find all of our episodes listed there. It's soundcloud.com/classicalclassroom. If you follow us on iTunes, make sure to rate and review us and make sure it's good. If you listen to us on SoundCloud, please follow us. It's just the nice thing to do. Thank you to our producer, Todd Toasty Hulslander, for twiddling knobs. To our program director, Sinjin Flynn, for offering spiritual guidance, as always. And to me for saying words. Also, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.